Now is the time for questions and answers. I'll try to respect and honor each one of the questions that came into the box if I can, and also to leave time for a couple of verbal questions. How do you stop clinging to wishes and fears? I think that this question is speaking to a phenomenon that we would like to get rid of, but they continue to obsess the mind, even though we think that we're tired of them and we'd like to let them go. The particular method I use for persistent useless or either useless or afflictive states of mind is first to try to have some clarity and honesty in terms of to what extent this experience is helping me and to what extent it's hurting me. Then I try with wisdom, if it's something that is really not helping me, that I want to let go of, I would break it down into how it's manifesting in the physical body, how it is experienced as a feeling, what are the perceptions, in other words, what names I'm giving to this experience, what is the volition associated there, what am I intending to do, and what is the consciousness. That's the five aggregates. So if the experience is, let's say, I'm addicted to the news, and I notice that when I'm tired at the end of the day, but I don't want to go into meditation and mindfulness, but I want to become numb, I might turn on and flip through some news websites. And I've recognized that as a bad habit. So then I would you know, specifically do the investigation. How is it? Like, what's the physical thing happening when I have that temptation? And what's the physical result of it? And then I may see if I can do something different physically. So like if I feel stressed out and exhausted at the end of a busy day with maybe too many things, maybe I could get more refreshment from taking a walk instead of looking at news. So I would do something different to try to shift something physical. What's happening is the mind and body is working together. And if the mind is in one fixed state and the body is in a corresponding state and they're locking together and feeding each other, and I can't seem to get out of this mental groove I'm in, if I can shift the physical body energy, that can also open the space for the mind to shift. But likewise, when there's I see the feeling part of it, I may investigate how transient the feelings are, how they come and go so easily, and develop a little bit more equanimity to be able to withstand unpleasant feelings without being upset about it, to just allow them to be there and to go on, and rather than going into reactivity. When I'm looking at perception, I ask myself this important question: is this perception true or false? Or is it true or is it distorted? And if the perception is distorted, I try to become a little more honest. Then the one about volition is actually the most powerful in this particular technique I have for getting out of persistent afflictive states. If I say, if I have this fears, okay? I have these fears. I would like inquire, like I'd talk to my fear and say, okay, Mrs. Fear, what is it that you really want me to do? And when I see like what the answer is, sometimes that's also like a dose of reality that kind of stops the whole thing, that is, enables me to be able to move out of the process. And then the consciousness in particular that I'm interested in is sometimes there's a kind of a conscious awareness where we are locked onto our object. The mind does not have the reflective, mindful way of seeing our own state, but instead becomes completely absorbed in something outside. And it can happen that our self-awareness is being built up by the story we say about something outside. So if I'm saying, that so-and-so always does that to me, and he's been doing that to me ever since, forever, and it, just like my father used to do the same thing to me, and I can't stand it when people are like that, and so, you know, some kind of story like that, then it may be that I'm giving myself some energy or something, or I'm making, you know, doing some kind of a protective thing for having some kind of like a self-image. I guess in that case, I would say that's a self-image of myself as a victim. And so do I really want to have the kind of consciousness that's like a victim self dealing with an oppressor or other or something like that? And when I see it clearly, then maybe I'm able to shift it in some way. The other so it's basically by way of working through this analysis with five aggregates to get rid of persistent states and developing wisdom as I'm trying to present with this three marks of existence to shift the whole point of view. If I'm really in a bad state, the safest and most comforting way to get the mind out of a negative groove and into a better groove to me is to open any of the discourses of the Buddha and just read discourses. And that somehow seems, for me, that's what's effective in getting out of a fixed groove. Can I speak about perception and projection? Perception is how we recognize, called sanya. So nya is knowing. This is in Buddhist, what the Buddhist word translated as perception. Is knowing something together with something else. So what we're doing is there's something we're experiencing in the here and now, and we're putting it together with something that we've learned and remembered from the past. And so I may see this object and recall that that's a rose because I've experienced them before and I've learned their name. So I get the perception of a rose, or I get the perception of red. And I may have a bunch of other perceptions because of whatever past experiences I've had with roses. I think by projection is when there's something that is actually an internal process that's happening within me, and I imagine that it's happening with other people, which could be accurate sometimes. Look at the Blessed One. You know, he didn't have hundreds of grad students subjecting themselves to questionnaires and tests in order to prove his theories. He was a human being, and he looked within himself And he knew his own reality at the most profound level. And then through that knowledge, he was able to discern what is also the reality for other beings. It's said that he had the supernormal vision, where he was able to see how other beings are born and reborn according to their karma. So the way he saw that was, first he saw how he had been born and reborn according to his own karma during his past lifetimes. And so from seeing it internally, one could have inferential knowledge that it's happening externally with others. So it's not, projection is not necessarily a bad thing, but it can be a bad thing if if we guess wrong. And someone who has a very strong psychological pattern assumes that I have the same pattern, but I don't. Not to worry about it. The main thing is that knowing that perception is part of the process that we use in building up our experience of the world, and that it's frequently unreliable. Oh, I like this one. How do we witness and support someone else's extreme anger and suffering? I think that, first of all, when the other person is in a wholesome, sort of like a Dharma relationship, that they're trying to work on their stuff and encountering obstacles in working on their business, and then connecting with me as being their spiritual friend. In a case like that, what I'm aiming for is a very neutral kind of full attention and full awareness to receive what they have at the particular moment without having a strong necessity to quick fix it because it's making me uncomfortable, or a need to necessarily condemn or judge or anything like that, but simply to know what's happening and to do some kind of a reflective process where I am acknowledging what they're experiencing. Then if they want my help to get out of it, I may try to respond in accord with the Dharma, what I understand is the relevant teachings of the Buddha that applies to anger. It happens in the monastery all the time, because people come to the monastery because they're suffering. And if they are practicing well, they're going deep, deep, deep into all of their stuff. And then their inner defilements, because it's a safe space, it can naturally happen that even people who are, you know, psychologically normal and healthy, not to mention people who have had all kind of difficulties in life, can come and they can experience a lot of fear, anxiety, anger, difficulties, all the business comes up. And then the role of the reason why the monastery is a therapeutic community is because then we have the ability to kind of like safely hold all this sometimes negative, difficult energy so that it can be experienced and the person is able to work through it and come around to a place of wisdom. You addressed ways to relieve our personal pain and suffering. What about the endless pain and suffering of others? What is our response? That's a very good question. So one part is, as I mentioned, this kind of witnessing. Another part is, in terms of the Buddhist precepts of morality, I think it's really completely suitable for a Buddhist to individually practice what is ethical, and also to speak up about what is ethical and to say, you know, I recommend not killing. I recommend not destroying the planet. And if you care about what I have to say, you know, this is my advice. In the case of many of the social problems that we confront today, the kind of this is a whole other talk. I gave this at I've been giving talks about Buddhist justice, like in the case of all of the social conflict that we've been having recently with institutional racism and violence against people, that a Buddhist process of justice is designed towards reconciliation, so that we have and we express very high standards of behavior and try to create a sense of community, not just with our own group, but kind of like a larger community that encompasses everybody and encompasses the bad guys as well as the good guys, and then try to enunciate these high expectations, but then also to have a safe way for individuals and institutions that have behaved badly to be able to make a sincere apology and to rectify their misbehavior and make amends and undertake a change so they don't continuously repeat the same bad actions. Instead of that, what's happening is, in our modern society, it's unsafe for institutions and people to admit their wrongdoing, because if they admit that they messed up, then they'll be in even worse trouble. So I highly recommend, you know, think of like at the end of apartheid, like what was done with the reconciliation in South Africa, anything that we can recommend and do to make our justice system more oriented towards rehabilitation and reconciliation. And it, I don't mean letting people get away with things, but I mean creating channels that make it possible for individuals and institutions to change in good ways. And that is very important work that's very relevant to ending suffering. So we don't have to, we can't stop the war unless we become peaceful inside. So we got to do the inside work to become peaceful ourselves. But when now that we've become peaceful and good, we can be engaged with society in real ways. Please give examples of how to manage extreme feelings of fear. Well, I sort of answered that. In addition to what I said before about the trying to break it down and basically subdivide the fear into its components in order to find something that we can get a handle on and shift in order to change the pattern. Another something that's really great is having a good friend. Fear is a kind of aversion. It's generally not a wholesome mind state. There's one kind of fear that is wholesome, and that is to be afraid to do something wrong because you would not want to get the consequences of evil, unwholesome, immoral behavior. So you're afraid to do something immoral. But you only need to be afraid just for a second, just long enough to not to stop from doing it. You don't want to be continuously beset by fear. If you are beset by fear, consider, okay, this is afflictive, it's a hindrance, it's a kind of aversion, it's not recommended by the Buddha. We don't want to live in this state. We want to find the ways to get out of it. And then find good friends, find good spiritual friends and mentors who you can confide in that can help you walk through. A lot of times with fear, what does fear do? It makes you stop. Like you're approaching something fearful and then you can't do it. Then get a friend to hold your hand to help you, you know, walk up and approach the thing that's fearful. And then at the same time you do all of the other work that's provided in the Dhamma. regarding intense emotional, physical anxiety states after losing to family and friends. What aspect of practice can help? I see the impermanence and how these deaths are expected and put me closer with my own mortality, yet still these states are fairly intolerable. Any thoughts? So time is a great healer after intense grief. If we can just be able to practice patient endurance with the difficult states, to have good friends, and to have hope that even though after a loss, it may seem that every time we think of our dear one, we think of something painful about it. That eventually the heart inclines towards healing and happiness if we give it space to do that. And eventually we'll be able to think of our dear one instead of remembering the most horrible, painful things. We'll remember the things that were delightful and beautiful and makes us smile and laugh. And we can also take hope in knowing that because we're having to go through the valley of intense difficulty, we're gaining something in terms of the capacity for real effective compassion, that we're not the only one who has to experience this. Other people experience loss and suffering. And if we can make it through, then we can become a really good, strong, effective bodhisattva that is able to help other people to get through their suffering, because we can show them that there is an end to it. There is a way to get out. Have the techniques associated with the three marks of existence been tried with mentally ill people or with those who become violently out of control? We had generally in times of extremity, we go in more towards a kind of a tranquility practice, and also having a very safe and protected environment. Actually, the monastery is great for people who are like psychopaths or something like that, because there's all these like rules and regulations, and it's all kind of like quiet, and there's not a lot of interaction, so there's not that much that's going to get them be triggered. Someday I'll start a mental health monastery where they can where we can get some people who really have those skills together with following a actually Buddhist path. But I've seen that the combination of loving kindness practice, tranquility oriented meditation, and a very structured, safe environment with rules and regulations, like you have to get up at this time, you have to be at meditation at this time, then you have to have breakfast, then you have your chore, and then you have lunch, and then you do another activity, and the whole day is kind of like programmed like that with very calm kinds of communication and interactions with people can be a nice healing space for people to do the work. I don't know about using the Tilakana specifically with mentally ill people. Can you speak to using this technique to understand and manage negative and critical conditioned thought patterns? How one can contemplate non-self impermanence and suffering when encountering powerful and painful ways of thinking negatively about oneself and others? In my own history, I had to first spend a number of years working on the medicine to use while I was actually in the middle of the afflictive states. And then later, when my experience with the afflictive states was like much quicker and more sporadic and not that dominating of my life, then I was able to work on doing these three elements, marks of existence meditation as a sort of a preventive medicine. So I think when one is in a state of extremity, try practicing for samadhi. Don't expect to accomplish anything in meditation. Just go with the breath and just, like, don't look for trouble. Trouble will come to you. Just watch the breath, relax, do deep relaxation, relaxing the body. And then when strong negative thoughts and feelings come up, try to just look at that and make a note of whether it's permanent or impermanent. And then as soon as you're able to, put that down and come back to doing tranquility work, tranquility practice. So I would say at least that one mark of existence about impermanence can be very useful when someone is in extremity. I would be careful about meditating on non-self when one is in an extreme emotional state, because there's a danger of the spiritual bypass. You said that non-self is inextricably intertwined with safety and not danger. This is fascinating, but could I clarify? Thank you. Okay. What I mean is, if my ego is very large and I'm identified with a lot of things as being part of my ego, like, let's say, all of my possessions, my mansion, my car, my job, my reputation, my career, and all of those things. And if I have such a brittle ego that if any of those things is impinged on, I can't bear the loss because I feel like it's hurt me, then I've got so much work to do in defending the self. But then if the self sort of gets, or the ego gets shrunken down to being sort of a right size, kind of a natural size, I have much less to defend, and it's a more relaxed kind of existence. But then the people who I see who are spiritual people with a very highly accomplished practice, it's the most remarkable thing to see how things that are seriously irritating can happen, and these people are like Teflon, like, It doesn't bum them, it doesn't burn them out, and they just come back in the same bright, friendly, and warm manner, speaking from the Dhamma, regardless of what kind of annoyance they've been subjected to. And I believe that that's because they're not identifying with things. So even if somebody has, like, messed up my monastery or something, you know, it's not me, not mine, it's all right. You know, even if somebody, let's say somebody disrespects Buddhism, it's not a problem. You know, if somebody is not following the right monastic etiquette and being respectful because I'm a bhikkhuni, and you should, you know, respect me because I'm wearing the banner of the arahant, the robes of the Buddha, so you should respect me, but maybe you won't. And so that's okay, because I'm not identifying with it because of my developing the awareness of non-self. And that way I'm safe because all of these insults don't hurt me. That's the safety. Is jhana practice part of your practice? Why not? I'm not a master of jhana, and in part I mentioned it earlier because as a recovering alcoholic and addict, I have got a deep resistance to bliss. Like, bliss is not safe for me. So, but I keep trying. When I feel pain, do I focus on it and go into it? or just try to ignore it and keep watching the breathing. If I'm doing a concentration practice, I would try to ignore the pain and not give it any special value. It's not that I'm pushing it away, but I'm just staying like kind of like neutral towards it. So my aim towards pain or anything afflictive is just a sort of evenly hovering attention combined with compassion. I'm not going to be able to do all these questions. Sorry. This one's too difficult. Sorry. to manage our stubborn Western minds, how do you feel about using cannabis and other substances to help in achieving a higher level of consciousness? No pun intended. Obviously, it can have some value. What is it? I think that the appropriate use of medicine for pain is definitely suitable, and I don't agree with people who say that, like, if we're a Buddhist, we should not use medication to help us to manage pain. Pain can be, like, to try to meditate when one is in severe pain, it can be really tough, and it could defeat you and make it impossible for you to practice. In using like a narcotic sometimes for, I don't know about using cannabis for pain. Using narcotic for pain, one can have the experience that this hurts but I don't care because it doesn't really relate to me or something. Like it's sort of like it's happening. It's a big level of detachment. And to my knowledge, people who use substances for pain are not getting high, are not getting heedless because of their substance use. They're just getting back to normal. And it's the same thing with using whatever medication is out there for depression or other kinds of states. I've heard that in treatment of depression, that using like psilocybin or magic mushroom kind of psychedelic drugs is now coming back in vogue, studied for depression, because in a depression the mind gets into a rut and it keeps like going through the same groove over and over again and digging that rut deeper and deeper and making it more fixed. And the doctors think that using psychedelics sort of like causes this massive interconnectivity and the whole blackboard is erased as far as the, you know, habitual patterns. So in combination with other kinds of therapy, who knows? I don't recommend using, I'm a monastic, I can't recommend using any substance that would cause heedlessness. In other words, that would make you become unmindful and to do without, you know, through lack of awareness, to make all kinds of other mistakes and to hurt yourself and others. What advice do you have for someone who thinks they may be in the awakening process? Meditation, relatively new for me, so on and so on. Read the suttas and learn about the path of gradual training, and just keep practicing mindfully. So we're all in a process of awakening, and the things that can open up for people at the beginning of their practice can be really incredible. Now, it might be that someone who just encounters Buddhism might, you know, have this many breakthroughs and then come to a plateau and go for a long time without further breakthroughs, and then could make some other progress because other circumstances in their life are evolving. Just try to don't get too excited with what you have, and try to methodically and regularly keep practicing, whether you're feeling breakthroughs or whether you're feeling a plateau. just keep on steadily practicing and learning. We're coming to our time?
Yeah, no. Well, yes. But we have Buddhist discourses available in the bookstore if anyone would like to check that out. They're kind of in a corner that you can't
okay.
see. So.
Good. Should I stop before 5 o'clock?
It's up to you. You can stop at 5, a little after 5, a little before.
Okay, with... okay, there's one question I wanted to answer. Not that one. can I please talk about forgiveness in Buddhism? I'm having a hard time forgiving someone who does not acknowledge the harm she has caused. I think there's one process which is about apology and forgiveness, which is part of the system of actually the system of justice and morality that we follow within the monastery and which I recommend for society, that we should make it easy for people to apologize when they've done something wrong and to try to amend themselves. And then if an apology is made, they ought to be forgiven. And rather than trying to further punish them, we should try to support them to become reconciled to the community and to amend their misbehavior. Now, when you have a person who doesn't see their fault and doesn't amend their behavior, in a certain kind of way, you're forgiving them. But I think the more relevant Buddhist idea is loving kindness and the Brahma-viharas. So if somebody is misbehaving and they don't see their fault, you yourself try to develop an attitude of kindness and friendliness towards them, regardless of what they're doing. You yourself have compassion for the suffering that they're in and for the unwholesome karmas that they're building up by their bad behavior. Even if you see someone behaves badly and they seem to get away with it, I guess you can have some sympathetic joy or mudita and appreciate, wow, lucky guy, they got away with it, and develop equanimity so that your own peace of mind is not going to be shaken up by whether the people around you are behaving well or badly. So I think the four Brahma-viharas are really the most relevant practice when someone doesn't see their fault, and that forgiveness is a really great practice to use when someone does see their fault. I can't see it. Somebody said it got lost. Somebody asked a question about becoming a Buddhist nun, asked what to do if they want to be a Buddhist nun, and how to know whether it's the right time or not. If you're interested in monastic life, I suggest visiting the monastery or the temple and hanging out with monks and nuns, and then going to visit and taking a short spells of residency in a monastic environment, and gradually extending the amount of time and seeing whether that particular situation is fruitful and makes you feel that you're able to advance in the practice. The right time to ordain would be when you have been able to, in an honest and clear way, taking care of your responsibilities. So if you have debts, you should pay them. If you have children, you should raise them or see that they are going to be properly taken care of. If you have a spouse, you should have an amicable resolution of the marriage, since monastic life is a celibate lifestyle that's not suitable for one who is still involved in being in love with their spouse. Then if you are free and you don't have any obligations, a good time to go forth is now, because you don't know when something's going to happen and you're going to lose the physical and mental abilities that you have now. So it might not be possible to do later on. I think think this is a... I'm sorry, I can't answer all of these questions. If I didn't answer your question, you can come up to me in the minutes afterwards, because I want to let everybody go on time. How can you maintain this state of being neutral when facing constant criticism about mistakes I make? How can one relax into what one is, i.e. the natural state, while competing for jobs which involve putting up a front? Yeah, right. That's a good time to enter monastic life. I was in a situation like that where I was asked to put up a front, asked to hate the enemies of our company, asked to cheat on my timesheet and do other kinds of improper things. Or else sometimes one is in a social environment which is very stressful. So one idea is to grow where you're planted and to just cope with the difficulties and challenges and to just stay there and don't move and be compassionate and learn to be contented with your situation, even though the situation is difficult in a lot of ways. You're not going to find a perfect situation. On the other hand, it's also true that especially a situation that is ethically compromised, it might be that you have to find a way to get out of that situation in order to make progress. And so it's your own call, and it's a very difficult call to make, because sometimes you should stay and sometimes you should leave. In terms of a family, if one is married and are in a committed relationship and there's children involved, I generally think that it's good to try to work it out and resolve it, so it's not try to avoid breaking the marriage unless you really have to. But if there's abuse, if there's real abuse, sometimes we have to go. I take time for one question from the floor. Okay.
It's interesting, your very last comment had to do with something I've been just waiting for or needing to hear, because to kind of piggyback on what the issue was just brought to the question of how do you deal with the constant bombardment of negativity, whether it's judgment or... I mean, and a very stressful work environment where your efforts are being thwarted or judged, or I mean, constant. You know, how do you separate it? How do you, the non-reactive part of what you were addressing today is something that I struggle with regularly, because mm-hmm. work is extraordinarily stressful. Mm-hmm. So the constant bombardment of having to separate and not react is so challenging.
Well, when I was the mother of the multiple employer welfare plan with all of those thousands of employees and their health insurance and their money and their bodies and being the central office for complaints, I think I sometimes had that. And I actually, the Buddhism was like so helpful in being able to stay stable and to not pick up and get all distressed every time something happened. I would say that the combination of the Dhamma and learning to practice a reflective listening or nonviolent communication or something, and then if you can practice it yourself, you may find that your own peace of mind is better, and also that other people will notice the difference, that they're not able to get your goat the same way that they did before. Stress is not, it's not the point. So you kind of just have to know this is dukkha. It's my problem. It's my puzzle, my challenge. How to find out how to hold the situation without picking it up and internalizing it. That's like part of what that grasping and craving is, that like it becomes an existential threat when there's a criticism and stress put on, or when there's a need or a necessity to do things. And instead, to just shift a priority and say, I want to stay centered, I want to stay mindful, I want to keep my loving kindness going. And you may find that even though it looks like you're slow, it might look like you're not as speedy as you used to be, it might be that you would be more productive as an employee because of taking the extra time, whatever it takes, to bring yourself back to center, to take the minute of mindfulness or a couple of deep breaths, and to center yourself and try to, regularly release the stress and not get completely absorbed into all the external things, thinking that if you solve the next 1,000 problems that come across your desk, that's going to take care of the problem, because it really doesn't take care of anything, really. I mean, that's the best I can say. Okay, so thank you all for your patient listening and for your good intentions, for the sincerity of your practice. I felt quite inspired in the last sit of meditation to see that even though it was late in the afternoon, that a lot of people were really working it. And I hope that you'll find something here that you can use and take home and continue to develop and grow your meditation practice and grow your wisdom and your personal welfare as a result of practicing this Dhamma.